and edited it from 1937 to 1939. His first detective novel, The Immaterial Murder Case, appeared in 1945, and it has been followed by more than a score of other mystery novels, and he's, of course, now recognized as one of the most formidable writers of that genre in the English-speaking world. He succeeded George Orwell as a regular reviewer for the Manchester Evening News in 1947 and continued until 1956. In 1958, he became a regular reviewer for the Sunday Times and has continued so ever since. He also writes frequently for the Times Literary Supplement, the London Magazine, and the London Review of Books. Julian Simmons is also well known as a biographer and a historian. He has written of Thomas Carlyle, Charles Dickens, and most recently of Edgar Allan Poe. By the way, he was awarded the American Award of the Edgar Allan Poe Award for mystery writing. His historical books include The General Strike, Historical Portrait, The 30s, A Dream Resolved, and England's Pride, The Story of the Gordon Relief Expedition. And his book, The Bloody Murder, is a study of the detective story as a genre. And his essays and books are collected in Critical Occasions. He's written a brief autobiography, Notes from Another Country. He recently succeeded Agatha Christie as president of the Detection Club. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a great pleasure to welcome to the Vancouver Institute a man of letters, Mr. Julian Simmons.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that brief rundown of my life and errors. And indeed, my first words must be thank you, not precisely to you, although I do thank you for being here, but thank you for the masterly map which I found waiting for me here, which is a crime map of Vancouver. It says, for example, that the second favorite body disposal site is Mount Seymour Park. This is the most beautifully done piece of work, and I hope to thank Helen Margaret Moore, who did it in person a little later on. Well, now, I'm due to talk tonight about the mystique of the detective story. This is a title so vague that it commits me to almost nothing. And it will be no surprise to you, I'm sure, to hear that I'm not going to talk precisely about the mystique of the detective story. I'm going to talk about the modern detective story, that is to say, about the way in which the detective story and crime story now differs from the standard article, as one might call it, of the past. But even to say the modern crime story poses a question. What do you mean by a modern crime story? Is it just one published in the last 10 years? Well, I do mean something actually different from the standard article. What's the standard article? The detective story as produced by Agatha Christie, Marjorie Allingham, Dorothy Sayers, all of the practitioners of what was called the Golden Age of the crime story, which roughly means the people in practice in the years between the wars. Anybody who writes crime stories and has met enthusiasts at parties knows that for many people the crime story has hardly changed in form since the days when it was begun by Edgar Allan Poe, nor in manners since the early tales of Agatha Christie. The poet W.H. Auden was one of these, that's to say, one of the people who thought that the crime story was an absolute firm, fixed form. He said, "The satisfaction given by it was like that of any other strict kind of formal art. The basic formula, he said, is this. A murder occurs. Many are suspected. All but one suspect, who is the murderer, are eliminated. The murderer is arrested or dies. And Auden went further than this. To give true satisfaction, he thought, the crime story must be set in a closed and peaceful society like that of an English village. So the detective, he thought, and this would be a very general thought of Golden Age crime writers, should be a kind of witch doctor who smelt out the corruption which had been spread by an evil individual. And the meaning of the whole detective story ritual, Auden thought, was that evil is cast out and replaced by good. The detective story writers of the Golden Age, which lasted, roughly speaking, from 1920, when Agatha Christie's first novel was published, to 1939, when Dorothy Sayers's last novel appeared, wouldn't have formulated things in quite that way. But their practice adhered very much to Auden's precepts, with a few additions, like a heavy concentration on social values that might, by an understatement, be called conservative. This is the kind of detective story. I think I should just give an idea of what this sort of detective story is. And this is the kind of detective story that everybody used to write and we all used to read. It would be set in the little English village of what a witty critic has called Mayhem Parva. The story is set at some time in the 1920s or 30s or 40s or even 50s, but the social attitudes are those of just before World War I. There are cars about, but somehow they don't disturb the essential peace of the village street, where Mr. Bun the baker and Mr. Pig the butcher, in his striped apron, are plying their trades. In the post office, which is also the general store, Miss Odd, the postmistress, is still selling bullseyes to small children in the intervals of listening in to telephone conversations. Up at the big house, and we really have a capital B and a capital H because the big house is so important, just outside the village, which stands in its own large grounds, a map of the grounds is included as a frontispiece. And which has its complement of servants, plus, of course, butler and chauffeur, Mr. Smythe is giving a house party. Mr. Smythe spells his name with a Y, but he's really Smith. And he's made his money recently by very dubious speculation, and as is the way of things, at least in Mayhem Parva and in stories of this kind, he's invited all the people who most detest him and have got good reason to kill him. There will be a current mistress and a discarded one. A brother or cousin who's in urgent need of money, which Mr. Smythe has refused to lend. And half a dozen others who may be relied on to make this a murderous house party. I say nothing of the servants, because in this kind of book, they're never guilty of more than a little squalid theft. As the American crime writer S.S. Van Dyne once observed, in fiction, crime must be committed by interesting people, and this definition excludes servants. Nor have I mentioned ever-present members of the cast of suspects in such books, the local solicitor and doctor, and Mr. Smythe's secretary. The crime writer John Dixon Carr once worked out that the secretary is the most likely person to have committed murder in such a story. Anyway, Mr. Smythe is killed in the library, map on page 44, stabbed by one of the Zulu assegais, which he thoughtlessly keeps on the wall. The local police are baffled, and it is not until two more murders have been committed that Hawkshaw, the great detective, is able to solve the mystery. Well, you think perhaps that I exaggerate in saying that that's a typical Golden Age crime story, and so I do. But not by much. Because like all parodies, this one has a basis of truth. The Golden Age stories, of course, had great virtues, which I'm far from denying. And the recent revival in the popularity of Dorothy Sayers shows also that even at their most snobbish, they retain a great many people who like them. But even the devotees would admit that not many Golden Age stories are written in these days. It's worth speculating, I think, just for a minute or two, on the reasons for its decline, on the feelings among writers as well as readers that they couldn't any longer use this kind of crime story. Credit is often given, or of course blame is laid if your feelings run that way, to the American writers Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler for writing a kind of crime story that made the Golden Age tale obsolete. And in a sense, I think this was true. Hammett particularly was the originator of something new, an approach to realism that made Golden Age crime stories look a little bit absurd. The question he asked of Ellery Queen, who of course himself was also a famous Golden Age writer, at a lecture: "Mr. Queen, will you be good enough to explain your famous character's sex life, if any?" is a deadly one, or at least it was in the context of its time. Who would have dared to attribute a sex life to Hercule Poirot, to Mr. Campion, to Nero Wolfe, to Philo Vance, or, of course, to the maddeningly pedantic Ellery? But once the question had been asked, then one was living in a different world, one in which the detective was no longer a superhuman being whose function was purely to solve mysteries, but a man like the rest of us, who bled, suffered, loved, and made mistakes, as we do. Such a man, for example, as Hammett's Sam Spade or Chandler's Philip Marlowe. At the same time, one shouldn't give too much weight to any individual writer's part in the change in the crime story, because it owes much more, I'm sure, to the shifts in social attitudes caused first by the Depression of the 30s and then by the Second World War. The immediate effect of the 30s Depression was to make Golden Age detective story writers close their ranks. Were there strikes, breadlines, soup kitchens, millions out of work? As writers, they felt that such things were none of their business. They were simply subjects that couldn't be accommodated within the fairy tale world of Mayhem Parva. But the 1939-45 war was another matter, because it shattered all the assumptions on which the classical detective story, the Golden Age detective story, was based. The Golden Age story is artificial in form, as deliberately so, I think, as a restoration comedy. And it's based on a very firm morality. It makes certain assumptions about the ways in which people are going to behave to each other, about honesty in public life, about the power of reason. In classical detective stories, servants know their place, which is below stairs. They may be dishonest or impertinent, but they will never be rebellious, never say that they're as good as their masters. And in such stories, the police may be foolish, but they're never dishonest. You could read 100 Golden Age crime stories before finding a policeman who took bribes. And the power of reason. Emotionally, Golden Age writers felt that peace must surely prevail in the world because war was so obviously irrational. Well, when the war came, it killed such ideas stone dead. And as for policemen, I suppose it would be true to say now, in relation to current crime stories, that any policeman in them must be thought guilty unless he's finally proved innocent. It remains a question, of course, how true our new view of authority is. Haven't there always been crooked policemen? Hasn't force always been the final arbiter in world affairs? I think I'd answer yes, that's true. But the important thing is the extent of corruption and the general social attitude towards it. I can remember the trial of corrupt police sergeants and inspectors in my youth. They were found guilty and sent to prison. But the real point is that they were generally condemned by society and their conduct was regarded as exceptional. Well, in recent years, the New York police force has been shown to be honeycombed with corruption from top to bottom. And in England, it was accepted long, long before the recent cases which have proved it, that many CID officers everywhere took bribes. This isn't to say that they did anything but behave as efficient police officers in most cases. They took bribes simply where and when that was the custom, from shops, restaurants, liquor stores, sellers of pornographic books and films. So, the degree of corruption that we've got in police forces and elsewhere is simply the degree of corruption that we accept. We accept things which we wouldn't have accepted in the years between the wars. All this isn't so far as it may sound from the modern crime story, because it's the assumptions about society on which it's founded that divide such stories most sharply from the detective stories of the past. I'm going to use as examples of the modern story some of my own books, not totally out of immodesty, but simply because I know them better than I know others, and the work of the American writer Patricia Highsmith and of two more recent English writers, P.D. James, who in fact is a woman, Phyllis James, and Ruth Rendell. I begin with Patricia Highsmith, who has been more open in her attitude than perhaps any other modern writer in what she thinks about crime. Take, for example, her naive but unequivocal admiration for criminals. "Criminals are dramatically interesting," she says, "because for a time at least they're active, free in spirit, and they don't knuckle down to anyone. I find the public passion for justice quite boring and artificial, for neither life nor nature cares if justice is ever done or not." Well, that's frank enough, and you may think outrageous. A writer of crime stories, admiring criminals indeed. Yet if we've read early crime stories, we shall realize that in those too, the criminal was often the hero, so that what she's saying is not so very new. It wasn't until the detective was firmly established by Dickens and Wilkie Collins, among others, as a defender of private property and the rule of law, that he became a hero. Highsmith's practice fulfills her precept in four novels to the extent of making the criminal, Tom Ripley, who runs through them, the hero. Ripley is a pleasant, engaging young American who quite simply lacks any moral sense. He kills to protect his comfortable way of life for the most part, sometimes because people make him angry. And the interest of the Ripley books is in seeing whether and how Ripley gets away with murder. These are the most popular books she's written, and the fact that we see things through the eyes of a criminal, not through the eyes of a detective, shows the extent of the change that's taken place in the crime story. I want to read a short passage from one of them, Ripley Underground, to show you the characteristic Highsmith flavour. In this book, Ripley has become involved with an art fraud by which fake pictures are being passed off as the work of an artist who is in fact dead. The book was written long before the recent forgeries in England and elsewhere, and it refers back rather to picture fakers like Van Meegeren in the Second World War. Anyway, an inquisitive and persistent American named Murchison senses there's something wrong with these pictures, and he pursues his inquiries to a point where they're obviously embarrassing to Ripley. Now, Tom Ripley doesn't dislike Murchison, he rather likes him. But he just wishes he'd stop fussing about the genuineness of the pictures. What does it matter? So, he invites Murchison over to his home in France, and there tries to persuade him that the paintings are genuine, but it's no good. "You won't possibly change your mind," Tom says, "just for the sake of sportsmanship, about speaking to an expert in London about these forgeries?" Murchison laughed a little. "Tom, I can't. Sportsmanship, I can't for the life of me see why you want to protect them." They go down to Tom's wine cellar, where he shows Murchison some very good clarets. And down here, Murchison slowly realizes that Tom himself is involved. When Tom says he really ought to let things alone, that the forgeries are doing no harm, Murchison refuses. "I'm damned if I'll keep my mouth shut about it. No, not even if you or anybody else offers me a whacking lot of money to keep my mouth shut." And Murchison, who's been given a bottle of very good claret by Tom to look at, puts the wine down rather hard on the floor. It doesn't break. But even so, Tom feels that the action is an absolute insult to his good claret. And that does it. The rejection of the wine was an insult, or so Tom felt now, a minuscule but further insult. Tom picked up the bottle almost at once and swung it at Murchison, hitting him on the side of the head. This time the bottle broke, wine splashed, and the base of the bottle fell to the floor. Murchison reeled against the wine racks, jiggling it all, but nothing else fell except Murchison, who slumped down, bumping wine bottle tops but not disturbing any. Tom seized the first thing to hand, which happened to be an empty coal scuttle, and swung it at Murchison's head. Tom struck a second blow. The base of the scuttle was heavy. Murchison was bleeding, lying sideways, his body somewhat twisted, on the stone floor. He wasn't moving. What to do about the blood? What to do about the blood? That's the sort of question that Tom Ripley has to deal with, which nobody ever dealt with in a classical crime story. What about the blood? How do you get rid of the body? How, in this case, do you make it seem that Murchison never came to see you at all, or perhaps left early? That is the kind of question that a Highsmith central figure always has to deal with, and part of the fascination of the story is how he does it. There's one really extraordinarily absorbing story, A Suspension of Mercy, in which the hero, if we call him that, does no more than think about how he might murder his wife, who's in fact away on holiday. What might he do? Wrap her up in a carpet after she died, smuggle her out of the house, bury her in the nearby woods? And he does all this, only, of course, with no body inside the carpet. But he's been spotted doing it. And when, to his surprise, his wife doesn't return from holiday, appears to have vanished, he's asked what happened to her and is suspected of murder. Well, these books of Patricia Highsmith's are remarkable books, remarkable in their implicit suggestion that a different and wholly personal code of morals should be substituted for the ordinary social code. They retain some elements of the Golden Age crime story in the sense that there's usually an intricate plot and the tension is increased through the story to a violent climax. But apart from that, almost everything has gone. Mayhem parva, country house life, conventional bourgeois characters, the very idea of heroes and villains. Like other American crime writers, Hammett and Chandler especially, Patricia Highsmith is only rated at what I would feel her proper worth in Europe. As Chandler observed, he had to come to England to be taken seriously. And it's in Europe, more particularly in Britain, France, and Scandinavia, that Patricia Highsmith is taken as seriously as, say, Margaret Drabble, Iris Murdoch, any other, in quotes, serious novelist. In her own country, and perhaps here too, I don't know, she's just another crime novelist and not a particularly popular one. I move on now to P.D. James and Ruth Rendell, the most recent stars in the criminal firmament. P.D. James's books I see around here in a number of shops. They're both of them given, at least by their publishers, the accolade the new queen of crime, ascending the throne vacant, left vacant by the death of Agatha Christie. An odd title, that, Queen of Crime, isn't it? There's never been any writer called the King of Crime, although the thriller writer E. Phillips Oppenheim was known as the Prince of Storytellers, and his books were publicized, this will show how long ago he was popular, by the phrase, "Turn off the radio, read an Oppenheim." Whether or not they're queens of crime, however, both Phyllis James and Ruth Rendell are very good writers who've emerged in the last decade. P.T. James's work, at first glance, contradicts a good deal of what I've been saying. She's been called a successor to Dorothy L. Sayers, and in a sense this is true. Those of you who've read her books will know that she shows the same care in plotting, has the same desire to make sure that every minor point is accurate, gives us dialogue that, like Dorothy Sayers, is I think, convincing rather than entertaining, as Agatha Christie's dialogue, for example, is always entertaining, to me at least. But the differences are more important than the similarities, and they do suggest the ways in which the crime story has changed. In P.D. James's third crime story, Shroud for a Nightingale, the setting is a training college for nurses. She was at one time a hospital administrator. And the solid creation of this setting is one of the reasons for the book's success. But the first chapter contains an account of a death, in fact a murder, which takes place during the demonstration of intragastric feeding, which would never have been attempted by Sayers or Christie or any other Golden Age writer. A trainee nurse is administering the feeding of milk by tube. And then the girl who was administering the feed lifted the funnel high over Nurse Pierce's head and began slowly to pour the milky mixture down the tube. The class seemed to be holding its breath. And then it happened. There was a squeal, high-pitched, horribly inhuman, and Nurse Pierce precipitated herself from the bed as if propelled by an irresistible force. 1 second, she was lying immobile, propped against her mound of pillows. The next she was out of bed, teetering forward on arched feet in a parody of a ballet dancer. And all the time she screamed, perpetually screamed like a stuck whistle. The milk has been replaced by carbolic acid. Now, I've said that description, which seems to me a very good, effective piece of writing, wouldn't have been attempted by Sayers, nor by Christie, nor Niall Marsh, nor Marjorie Allingham. Why not? Well, the essential reason is that it's too frighteningly near the real world. It's a long way removed from the old buffer being found dead in the Bellona Club or the body in the library. And although P.D. James's stories are in some respects quite conventional murder mysteries, all after the first two or three are marked by very firm and careful construction of character and a concern to see that the plot springs out of the way the characters act and react on each other. She has a very plausible police detective named Adam Dalgleish, intelligent but not a superman. And in her later books, she's been pushing, as a modernist must, against the boundaries of the old-fashioned detective story. She's done so in terms of subjects. The Black Tower, which is perhaps her very best book, is set in a home for incurables. And her last book, Innocent Blood, concerns an adopted girl who seeks out her real mother and father to learn that the father raped a girl underage and that her mother killed the girl when she refused to keep quiet. It's noticeable that the writer flinched, perhaps not surprisingly, from the implications of this part of the subject, so that the rape wasn't exactly what we think of as a rape, nor the murder was precisely a murder. Innocent Blood was an enormous commercial success, but not, I think, a literary one, partly as a result of this. Both of these books are rather cozy reads, you may be surprised to hear, when I think from a literary point of view, they ought to be uncomfortable ones. But this, again, is to be critical, perhaps hypercritical, on a high level. And there's no doubt about Phyllis James's enormous talent. Nor about that of Ruth Rendell, who said once that she thought Christie was superficial, but yearned to be mentioned in the same breath with Patricia Highsmith and Julian Simmons. Well, that's a very kind remark. And it's not surprising, you may feel, that I'm mentioning her. But what sort of books does the woman write who makes such a remark? Surprisingly enough, two distinctly different kinds of book. And if one is rather like Highsmith, the other isn't altogether removed from Christie. at least in offering some quite stunning surprise endings. The Highsmith kind of Rendell offers studies in abnormal psychology. For example, a book called A Demon in My View, which won the English Crime Writers Award for the best novel of the year, is about a repressed, shy man named Arthur Johnson who keeps a dummy in his cellar and finds ecstatic pleasure in strangling her every few days. This may sound a thin basis for a full-length crime story, but Rendell develops it most cleverly, with trouble coming to Arthur Johnson when another man who happens to have the same surname comes to live in the same rather dismal house. There's a confusion over letters opened by the wrong Mr. Johnson. The other Johnson stays in every evening, and his window overlooks the door leading to the cellar, so that Arthur doesn't like to go down there, and he's driven to an act of real strangulation. It's not till we're some way through the book that we learn Arthur has done this before. The similarities to Highsmith will be obvious. The usual Rendell book of this kind is about somebody who has some slight kink or abnormality, which, when placed under emotional stress, moves them to an act of violence. They aren't as good as Highsmith, I think, although they're more reasonable and even probable, because she lacks that edge of intensity in which Highsmith is unique among present-day crime writers. But I should say something about the other kind of Rendell book, which is perhaps more easily readable. These are police stories set in a town named Kings Markham somewhere in Sussex, and they have for central character Chief Inspector Wexford, who's around 60, happily married with two daughters, a bit literary, had a thrombosis a few years back, and has taken off a couple of stone in weight. Wexford is an excellent, most convincing character, and he has as a sidekick the equally convincing Inspector Burden, very puritanical figure, who's inclined to distrust modern youth and to put down Wexford's instinctive feelings about a case. Kings Markham is admirably created, and Wexford's occasional visits to London are also very well done. And the cases themselves? Well, these again show what divides the modern crime story from the Golden Age tale. There's a story, for example, which involves transvestism, another which is based wholly on the hatred members of a family feel for each other. A witty book reviewer once said that in a Rendell novel, a couple is not a happy thing to be. And in her chosen area, which is always something like suburbia, and among her chosen characters, who are mostly professional people, middle class or a little bit lower, her eye and ear are absolutely unerring. The conversations between these people are real, and so they are when Wexford talks to them. The people are the kind you're likely to meet any day, in an estate agent's office, a laundrette, a pub, anywhere. If one wanted to introduce somebody who was not English to the flavour of British life, or to the flavour at least of town life, I think that Ruth Rendell would be a novelist who would introduce them just as well as any who are more seriously regarded but don't write crime stories. And if I had to plump for one recent crime writer, and by recent I mean one who's matured greatly in the last 5 or 6 years, whom I'd read rather than any other, it would be Ruth Rendell. And so I move on to my own crime stories. And the basic purpose that lies behind them, or behind some of them at least, because I'm aware of several disastrous mishits in my own work, as well as a number of intentionally flippant or light-hearted books. I write these when there's a chorus of book reviewers who say, well, you can't write anything but really very gloomy and miserable books. I then write a light-hearted one, and they then say, well, if only you got back to your former style, we would really listen to you, and we really should appreciate it. We thought those were very good. But there is a pattern in my own books, and I think it's interesting in more than a purely personal sense, because it's a long way removed from life in Mayhem Parva and yet it still bears a relationship to it. Interesting also, perhaps, because like the patterns in the work of many writers, it isn't altogether conscious. 2 or 3 years ago, a young BBC television producer made a film about my work, which he called Games. And it was only in the course of conversation with him that I came to realize how completely my own crime stories were based on the idea that we are all playing games in our lives, and that crime is likely to occur when the games, which are basically protective devices, become real. The way the producer used this idea in his film was to show scenes from different books in which the same actors bodied out particular repeated fantasies of power and repression among the characters in the stories, to show that we're all attempting to escape from reality through one kind of fantasy or another. I should say, since I've also been talking about this on TV, that it seems to me that this is an absolutely natural and perfectly harmless thing to do, that we all of us have fantasies, that we are all of us, and I include all or almost all of you in the audience, potential murderers, and that we may well murder for something as trivial, as apparently trivial, as the way in which our partner in life spreads the marmalade on the toast, or something of that sort. These sparking points for murder are, of course, not the actual reasons, but the sparking points can often be absolutely as trivial as that. Let me body out what I'm talking about with one or two concrete instances. In a book called The Man Who Killed Himself, a fairly cheerful book, I'm happy to say. I can see you'll be feeling I've been talking about books which are fairly grim, but in fact neither P.D. James's books nor Ruth Rendell's are as grim as I've been making them sound. If one abstracts a plot and takes away the characterization, which can give a great deal of humor and liveliness, you are liable to make things sound much grimmer than they are. Anyway, in The Man Who Killed Himself, the central character is a meek little bald-headed man named Arthur Brownjohn, who has an overbearing wife named Claire. Arthur mows the garden. Claire tells him not to do it in his best trousers. After he's had a single glass of sherry, when other people are there, she says sharply, "Arthur, you shouldn't drink anymore. You know you've got no head for drink," and so on. And Arthur bears with Claire. Claire dominates Arthur. Now, by a series of chances, which I hope will seem more plausible in the book than they do as I'm telling them to you, Arthur discovers that there is money to be made out of running a matrimonial agency. He starts one accordingly. He calls himself Major Easenby Mellon, which he thinks is a good round name, and he wears a handsome red wig and beard so that he shan't be recognized. But Major Easenby Mellon soon becomes a different person from Arthur Brownjohn. Timid Arthur has no success with ladies, but the major gets all the girls. He marries bigamously and sets up another household with a woman who is in every way the reverse of Claire, sluttish, complacent, a kind of doormat where Claire is a stone goddess. He lives, and you'll hardly need me to tell you that this is not all that unusual, a double life. This double life is wrecked by mishaps, which again I don't want to discuss in detail, but which you can easily imagine. And the heart of the plot is Arthur Brownjohn's attempt to escape from both these lives, which have become so terribly tangled, and to start afresh. Neither Arthur Brownjohn nor Easenby Mellon is, he feels, his real self. And in the process of trying to discover this real self, and to cut the knots binding him to what he wishes to regard as the past, he turns to murder. He kills Claire, and by what seems to him a masterstroke, makes it clear that the murderer is Major Easenby Mellon. Rid of both these encumbrances, he can start again as himself. But of course, the trouble is that such a self doesn't exist. that his personality has no reality beyond that of the masks that he's assumed. That's a book in which the idea of playing games is used mostly for comic purposes. In a more recent story called The Players and the Game, the results are horrific. This is a story based upon a very famous English murder case known as the Moore's Murders, in which a man and a young woman caught young children, tortured them, and recorded the torture on tape, then killed them. One extraordinary feature of the case was that the two interacted powerfully on each other. The man, Ian Brady, had been interested in torture ever since his childhood, but there's no indication that he'd ever practiced it until he met the woman. The woman, Myra Hindley, had been brought up very strictly and had led a blameless and what might be called an extremely virtuous life until she met Brady. They did things together which perhaps neither of them, and certainly not Hindley, would have done alone. Now, why should one use such a sordid and horrific tale as the basis for a crime story? It's an obvious question, and of course one that I've been asked. Well, partly because it actually happened. That is, it seems to me there should be no subjects barred from any writer. There's nothing about which we ought to say, this is outside the realm of fiction, you mustn't write about it. And the fact that crime fiction is so widely regarded still as a form of writing stamped for amusement only makes it, in my view, all the more necessary to assert and to show that it isn't true. But you'll also see that the Moore's Murders exemplifies what I've been saying about people wearing masks. When Hindley was arrested, it was difficult for people who knew her to believe that she could possibly have done the things of which she'd been accused. At the same time, life is not fiction. It's the raw material of fiction. My two protagonists play games in their imagination, one of them pretending that he's Dracula, the other that she's Bonnie of Bonnie and Clyde. These games get no further than their imaginations until they meet. And when they meet, the games slowly turn into horrific reality. Well, I said just now that these books bore a relationship to those conceived in terms of Mayhem Parva, and you may wonder what that relationship could possibly be. It rests in my own regard for the Golden Age detective story, my reluctance to throw it all away. I like to read books in which there's a kind of puzzle to be solved at the end, books in which a question has to be answered. I don't want the question necessarily to be the orthodox whodunit, or even why was it done. And indeed, like other modern practitioners, I'm always pushing away of the barriers put up by the Mayhem Parva formula. For example, I once wrote a story in which the point for the reader was that he had to ask the standard questions about exactly what had happened, but at the end he remained unsure of the answers. My central character thought that his wife was having an affair with a partner in his firm and believed also that he'd killed the partner. But at the end of the story, neither he nor we are certain about any of this. The reception of the book, The Man Who Lost His Wife, wasn't such as to induce me to embark on any similar experiment. But it still seems to me an interesting idea. But still, to end what's really a long parenthesis, I do demand, something in me requires, that there shall be questions for the reader to answer. I like playing games as much as the characters in my stories, or as much, in my belief, as readers. So in The Man Who Killed Himself, the reader doesn't know what's going to happen in the end to Arthur Brown-John. And in The Players and the Game, I've done my best to conceal the identities of both Dracula and Bonnie by what seemed to me a fairly brilliant piece of juggling with extracts from journals, you don't know who's written them, and other pieces of trickery. If you said to me that tricks like that, however cunningly devised, must inevitably diminish the seriousness with which a total work can be regarded, I'd agree. In a way, I wish I didn't feel the need for them. It's because of the existence of tricks of that sort, in my work and in the work of other crime writers I respect, that one can't put the crime story on the highest level as an art form. Whatever its merits may be, it does begin and end as sensational literature. But the question of what those merits are, or may be, is the one I'd like to end with. Some of you, I'm sure, will have read that scathing dismissal of all detective stories by Edmund Wilson called Who Cares Who Killed Roger Ackroyd? And will remember his conclusion, which ran roughly, I'm paraphrasing, not quoting directly, that when so many masterpieces remain unread, whatever is the point of burdening ourselves with all this rubbish? That would also, no doubt, have been the view of F.R. Leavis, with his inclination to divide all fictional work into the few masterpieces on the one hand and the great mass of detritus that must be shoveled, indeed that he lent a willing hand in shoveling, onto the garbage dump. And there is a sense in which nobody can disagree with Wilson and Leavis. What possible excuse is there for reading Agatha Christie or Marjorie Allingham or Ruth Rendell or Julian Simmons when Pascal and Blake or both Samuel Butlers or Melville and Hawthorne lie unopened on the shelves? If we judge by literary standards purely, sufficiently scholarly to have delved deeply into Edmund Wilson's work, will remember that he was once a regular attendant at burlesque shows and admired the art with which bumps and grinds were executed. Almost none of us lives the whole time upon the level of masterpieces, and many writers of crime stories indeed will have purred with satisfaction to be told by an intellectual lady at a party how much she enjoys his work, although he may cease purring when she goes on to say that she always finds it sends her to sleep at night. But as you'll have gathered from the drift of this talk, I wouldn't want my own defense of crime stories simply to rest there. I should claim that in the general drift away from narrative in the novel, as it's seen in the work of almost every highly regarded novelist now, from Iris Murdoch to Norman Mailer, to Anthony Burgess, to Saul Bellow, the crime story in which a narrative is the very first thing that has to be emphatically there has got particular merits for our own time. But more than this, I should say that the crime story has a relevance to the age we live in. It's a truism, yet it's still true, that we live in a time of especial violence. And how can that be expressed better than in a crime story which takes violence seriously? I would go further and say that the public violence we see around us can perhaps be commented on most effectively through the private violence of individual crime. It must be evident, for example, to anyone who's read novels about World War II or the conflict in Vietnam, that these are peculiarly difficult subjects for a novelist. They ask to be dealt with in a realistic way, yet their scope is so wide, the horror of things like the concentration camps or napalm bombing, so much beyond anything we encounter in what we think of as ordinary life, that the most successful works dealing with them have tended to be fantasies like Catch-22 or documentaries like John Hirst's book about Hiroshima. It would take the genius of a Tolstoy to write a straightforward novel about Vietnam. And Tolstoy's are always in short supply or no supply at all. So it may well be that for novelists of lesser ability, private violence is the best image for public horror. A really terrifying case, like the Moore's murders, or in the United States, the Manson killings, opens up some of the questions relating to power and responsibility which arose in Vietnam. In the same way that Bertolt Brecht asked, what is the robbing of a bank compared to the founding of a bank? One might ask, what are the private murders of a few children compared with the organization of killing in Vietnam? What was the guilt of Brady or Hindley compared to the guilt of Lieutenant Calley or of a bomber pilot? I'm not suggesting for a moment that the answers are evident, or indeed that there is any single or simple answer at all, only that one may be able to pose the questions through the account of an individual act of violence, better than in a long novel that conscientiously tries to count the number of dead and to describe in detail the horrific ways in which they died. What the modern crime story can do, in short, is to say something of interest about our own time. It's a form of entertainment literature. Don't think I disregard that primary fact and duty, although I've talked about it only very indirectly tonight. But along with the entertainment, it can offer something more. The fine art of murder, as Thomas De Quincey called it, can tell us something about the world we live in and about the best way of living peacefully in it. Thank you.
Mr. Simmons has agreed to answer questions. Please keep them short and speak clearly. Yes, sir.
I wonder why Mr. Simmons did not mention any male writers.
Well, I did mention myself. Perhaps so. Somebody said, I've killed all the rest. I chose those three writers as being examples of very good modern crime writers, and it does so happen that they are all women. I could have mentioned some male writers. I very much admire the American crime writer George V. Higgins. I very much admire two Swedish crime writers whose names I hesitate to pronounce, but they are something like Shuval and Valu, who wrote in collaboration. But upon the whole, I would feel that those three women writers are as good, or perhaps better, than any comparable men, and that's why I mention them.
Yes, yes, madam.
I'm sorry, I haven't quite got that.
Why is it that such a great percentage of the leading crime writers are women? Were there any thoughts on that?
Why is it, you think, that such a great percentage of crime writers are women? Do you have any comments on that?
Well, I've been asked this question before, and I seem rather to have agreed with it by mentioning three women writers. I'm not sure that it's true. I think if you made a count of heads, it wouldn't be true. I think there are more. If one took, as you might say, the top 100, though I'm far from wanting to make a kind of league table, you would find that half of them at least were men. I might have mentioned, for example, I might have talked about Maigret and Simenon, who clearly was an example of a realistic crime writer of the sort I'm talking about. It's only because he belongs a little bit to the past that I didn't mention him. So I think I wouldn't accept that it's quite true that they're mostly women.
Yes, ma'am.
Is there anybody without
masks?
Do we exist without our masks?
Well, this is a very good question. Do we exist without our masks?
How many do masks
do we have? Yes. You'll remember the Max Beerbohm story about Lord George Hell, who always wore a mask, but then when he removed the mask, it was actually the face of Lord George Hell. I think we all wear masks. I regard all you admirable ladies and gentlemen as wearing masks, which conceal some other personality, as I wear one myself. I think probably the mask is hardly ever taken off, and I think also that is a good thing. I think murder... I think murder is what is most likely to occur. Most murders are likely to occur when the mask is removed. Oh, perhaps not. No, no. I wouldn't wish to deny anybody at all a multiple number of masks. One at least, shall we say?
Yes, sir. How would you classify Iris Murdoch?
I'm not a great admirer.
Modern or classical?
Yes, I. I'm not sure that I could elaborate without elaborating for half an hour or so on what I would feel to be the limitations of the later Iris Murdoch books. But basically, I suppose I would feel, as I said, that they are more or less plotless, or that the kind of plots they've got are unsatisfactory because they're plots of an unrealistic kind about characters who portend to be depicted as realistic characters. That seems to me always a very unfortunate, unhappy thing to do. It seems to me a recipe for failure. But I'm in such a minority here that you may well feel, I dare say you do, that my view is not worth having.
Yes, sir.
From what you said a few minutes ago, you seem rather cynical about the human race when you said the real self is when your mask is off, is when you're committing murder. In other words, you're a violent character, basically. I'm sure there are a lot of people that are quite way removed from violence, and their real selves are far from being violent. And I didn't want to know, I thought maybe you meant by that the real people are all violent once they remove their mask.
I'm sorry if I gave the impression that when masks are removed, we are all violent. I didn't intend to convey that. What I do feel is that all of us have at least two personalities. All of us have some crack in what may appear to be an absolutely perfectly smooth surface. There is always a crack somewhere. There is always a division somewhere. It's when that crack, that division, becomes a wide one, when our single personality splits into multiple ones, the violence is most likely to occur. That really was all I meant to say.
Yes, sir.
I keep thinking of Colin Wilson's novels when he mentions the criminals, a sort of existential hero that breaks through the fakeness by doing something radical and rather violent. So have you thought of writing a novel that really goes into the criminal as a hero?
I wouldn't myself want to write a book in which a criminal was a hero as such, no. If you ask me why, I don't think I could reasonably answer. It's not something that would appeal to me. I don't enjoy the Ripley books of Patricia Highsmith as much as I enjoy some of her other books, although I think they're very good of their sort. They don't have the appeal for me that they do have to a lot of readers. So I wouldn't want to do that, but I think it would be an interesting thing to do, and Colin Wilson has tried to do it, certainly.
Yes, sir.
I wonder, would you regard Nicholas Blake as a bridge between the Golden Age and the current age?
Would I regard Nicholas Blake as being a bridge? Yes, indeed, I would. Along, of course, with a number of other writers. I've been oversimplifying grossly in dividing writers in between the Golden Age writers and denying them any sort of characterization and other writers who do evolve fully realized characters. And Nicholas Blake, along with a number of others, would of course be one of the bridges. I would feel about his work that he started off much better than he went on. That in fact he really, like many crime writers, took much more interest in his early stories, and that he lost interest in the later ones.
Yes, sir, back there.
Do you see a strong relationship between Raffles and Ripley?
In between?
Raffles.
A relationship between Raffles and Ripley. I just wondered...
In between Raffles and Ripley? Well, that's a very ingenious idea, and I think certainly it's the subject, potential subject for an essay, like Orwell's one about Raffles and Miss Blandish. Raffles and Ripley would be a very good subject. And yes, I do think there is a sense in which Ripley is the horrific modern counterpart of Raffles.
Yes, sir.
J.S. Marrick.
J.J. Marrick. The difference is important because J.J. Marrick was the pseudonym, one of the 24 pseudonyms used by John Creasy, and the name sprang from his own name, John, his wife's name, Jean, and the names of his sons, Martin and Richard, hence J.J. Marrick. The Marrick stories are police procedural stories, that's to say, stories which portend to give a reasonably realistic account of police life and police investigation. And I thought they were among the very best stories that John Creasy wrote. When he started writing them, I urged him not to write too many of them, not to write them too fast. One of the things was that writing as he did so many books, having 24 different names, he wrote obviously rather too many. And he said to me, "Yes, I know, Julian, I know I write too many. I try to restrain myself. I try to keep myself down to writing 12 books a year. I can't do it. I find I write 14. Well, the J.J. Marrick books, which I thought started off very well indeed, which were much better than any other Creasy books, they faded away simply because he wasn't able to restrain himself. He went on writing them, and like a great many writers of crime stories especially, he did overproduce even the Marricks, I thought. But the first ones I thought were extremely good.
One last question, yes.
I haven't heard that.
From my introduction, he took it that you seemed dissatisfied with your education. What would you consider to be a satisfactory education?
How can one be dissatisfied with no education? I think a satisfactory education is what appears to you to have been a satisfactory education, you know, what appears to the individual to have been a satisfactory one. In a sense, I'm satisfied with my own lack of education. I left school at 14. That's what I refer to as a lack of education. In a sense, I think it's an advantage not to be educated, not to go to a university. There is also obvious senses in which it's a tremendous disadvantage. It's been an immense disadvantage to me, not in writing crime stories, whereas perhaps there's been an advantage to be thrown out into the world at a very early age. But in writing other work, writing a biography, knowing the sort of methods to use, when I started to write a biography, first of all, I was really so ignorant of research methods, of how to do things. I couldn't possibly have been as ignorant if I'd had any sort of education up to the age of 18 or further. So an advantage and a disadvantage. I think if you feel you've been badly educated, then you must have been badly educated. If you feel it doesn't matter, as upon the whole in my own case, I would feel it doesn't matter. well, then it's all right.
With that, with that rather satisfactory but provocative last answer of Mr. Simmons, I'd like to ask Professor Ira Nadell of the Department of English at UBC to thank Mr. Simmons on our behalf.
Mr. Simmons, when a friend of the 19th century poisoner, Thomas Wainwright, reproached him for the murder of a 20-year-old woman, he shrugged his shoulders and said, "Yes, it was a dreadful thing to do, but she had terribly thick ankles." Well, from this remark, Oscar Wilde concluded that the fact of a man being a poisoner is nothing against his prose, and furthermore added that there exists no essential incongruity between crime and culture. Well, tonight, Mr. Simmons, you have vividly shown that unity between crime and culture, clarifying, I think, our fascination with the mystery story and proving, as this large audience certainly indicates, that in the words of Leslie Stephen, the intelligent detective is a drug on the market. On behalf of the Vancouver Institute, I want to thank you for your sleuthing, your detecting, and indeed solving that puzzling phenomenon, the mystique of the detective story. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you will show your appreciation by considering joining the Vancouver Institute. We do need your support. And we hope to see you next week when the distinguished philosopher Donald Davidson from the University of Chicago will deliver the Dal Grauer Memorial Lecture. And I want to announce as well that on April the 4th, the Vancouver Sun Lecture will be given by Donald Seller, the Washington, D.C. correspondent of the Southern Press, and he will be talking on the new administration. Thank you very much. See you next week.